A Rivermouth Romance. I. At 5 o'clock on the morning of the 10th of July, 1860, the front door of a certain house on Anchor Street, in the ancient seaport town of Rivermouth, might have been observed to open with great caution. This door, as the least imaginative reader may easily conjecture, did not open itself. It was opened by Miss Margaret Callahan, who immediately closed it softly behind her, paused for a few seconds with an embarrassed air on the stone step, and then, throwing a furtive glance up at the second-story windows, passed hastily down the street towards the river, keeping close to the fences and garden walls on her left. There was a ghost-like stealthiness to Miss Margaret's movements, though there was nothing whatever of the ghost about Miss Margaret herself. She was a plump, short person, no longer young, with coal black hair growing low on the forehead, and a round face that would have been nearly meaningless if the features had not been emphasized, italicized, so to speak, by the smallpox. Moreover, the brilliancy of her toilet would have rendered any ghostly hypothesis untenable. Mrs. Solomon, we refer to the dressiest Mrs. Solomon, whichever one that was, in all her glory was not arrayed like Miss Margaret on that eventful summer morning. She wore a light green, shot silk frock, a blazing red shawl, and a yellow crepe bonnet profusely decorated with azure, orange, and magenta artificial flowers. In her hand she carried a white parasol. The newly risen sun, ricocheting from the bosom of the river and striking point blank on the topknot of Miss Margaret's gorgeousness, made her an imposing spectacle in the quiet street of that Puritan village. But, in spite of the bravery of her apparel, she stole guiltily along by garden walls and fences until she reached a small, dingy frame house near the wharves, in the darkened doorway of which she quenched her burning splendor, if so bold a figure is permissible. 3/4 of an hour passed. The sunshine moved slowly up Anchor Street, fingered noiselessly the well-kept brass knockers on either side, and drained the heel taps of dew which had been left from the revels of the fairies overnight in the cups of the morning glories. Not a soul was stirring yet in this part of the town, though the Rivermouthians are such early birds that not a worm may be said to escape them. By and by one of the brown holland shades at one of the upper windows of the Bilkins mansion, the house from which Miss Margaret had emerged, was drawn up, and old Mr. Bilkins in spiral nightcap looked out on the sunny street. Not a living creature was to be seen, save the dissipated family cat, a very Lovelace of a cat that was not allowed a night key, who was sitting on the curbstone opposite, waiting for the hall door to be opened. 3/4 of an hour, we repeat, had passed, when Mrs. Margaret O'Rourke, née Callahan, issued from the small, dingy house by the river, and regained the doorstep of the Bilkins mansion in the same stealthy fashion in which she had left it. Not to prolong a mystery that must already oppress the reader, Mr. Bilkins's cook had, after the manner of her kind, stolen out of the premises before the family were up, and got herself married, surreptitiously and artfully married, as if matrimony were an indictable offense. And something of an offense it was in this instance. In the first place Margaret Callahan had lived nearly 20 years with the Bilkins family, and the old people, there were no children now, had rewarded this long service by taking Margaret into their affections. It was a piece of subtle ingratitude for her to marry without admitting the worthy couple to her confidence. In the next place, Margaret had married a man some 18 years younger than herself. That was the young man's lookout, you say. We hold it was Margaret that was to blame. What does a young blade of 22 know? Not half so much as he thinks he does. His exhaustless ignorance at that age is a discovery which is left for him to make in his prime. Curly gold locks cover foolish brains, billing and cooing is all your cheer, sighing and singing of midnight strains, under Bonnie Bell's window panes, wait till you come to 40 year. In one sense Margaret's husband had come to 40 year, she was 42 a day. Mrs. Margaret O'Rourke, with the baddish cat following close at her heels, entered the Bilkins mansion, reached her chamber in the attic without being intercepted, and there laid aside her finery. 2 or 3 times, while arranging her more humble attire, she paused to take a look at the marriage certificate, which she had deposited between the leaves of her prayer book, and on each occasion held that potent document upside down, for Margaret's literary culture was of the severest order, and excluded the art of reading. The breakfast was laid that morning. As Mrs. O'Rourke set the coffee urn in front of Mrs. Bilkins and flanked Mr. Bilkins with the broiled mackerel and buttered toast, Mrs. O'Rourke's conscience smote her. She afterwards declared that when she saw the two sitting there so innocent-like, not dreaming of the comether she had put upon them, she secretly and unbeknownst let a few tears fall into the cream pitcher. Whether or not it was this material expression of Margaret's penitence that spoiled the coffee does not admit of inquiry, but the coffee was bad. In fact, The whole breakfast was a comedy of errors. It was a blessed relief to Margaret when the meal was ended. She retired in a cold perspiration to the penetralia of the kitchen, and it was remarked by both Mr. and Mrs. Bilkins that those short flights of vocalism, apropos of the personal charms of one Kate Carney who lived on the banks of Killarney, which ordinarily issued from the direction of the scullery, were unheard that forenoon. The town clock was striking 11, and the antiquated timepiece on the staircase, which never spoke but it dropped pearls and crystals, like the fairy in the story, was lisping the hour, when there came three tremendous knocks at the street door. Mrs. Bilkins, who was dusting the brass-mounted chronometer in the hall, stood transfixed, with arm uplifted. The admirable old lady had for years been carrying on a guerrilla warfare with itinerant vendors of furniture polish, and painkiller, and crockery cement, and the like. The effrontery of the triple knock convinced her the enemy was at her gates, possibly that dissolute creature with 24 sheets of notepaper and 24 envelopes for 15 cents. Mrs. Bilkins swept across the hall, and opened the door with a jerk. The suddenness of the movement was apparently not anticipated by the person outside, who, with one arm stretched feebly towards the receding knocker, tilted gently forward, and rested both hands on the threshold in an attitude which was probably common enough with our ancestors of the Simian period, but could never have been considered graceful. By an effort that testified to the excellent condition of his muscles, the person instantly righted himself, and stood swaying unsteadily on his toes and heels, and smiling rather vaguely on Mrs. Bilkins. It was a slightly built but well-knitted young fellow, in the not unpicturesque garb of our marine service. His woolen cap, pitched forward at an acute angle with his nose, showed the back part of a head thatched with short yellow hair, which had broken into innumerable curls of painful tightness. On his ruddy cheeks a sparse sandy beard was making a timid debut. Add to this a weak, good-natured mouth, a pair of devil-may-care blue eyes, and the fact that the man was very drunk, and you have a Pre-Raphaelite portrait, we may as well say it at once, of Mr. Larry O'Rourke of Mullingar, County Westmeath, and later the United States Sloop of War Santee. The man was a total stranger to Mrs. Bilkins, but the instant she caught sight of the double white anchors embroidered on the lapels of his jacket, she unhesitatingly threw back the door, which with great presence of mind she had partly closed. A drunken sailor standing on the step of the Bilkins mansion was no novelty. The street, as we have stated, led down to the wharves, and sailors were constantly passing. The house abutted directly on the street, the granite doorstep was almost flush with the sidewalk, and the huge old-fashioned brass knocker, seemingly a brazen hand that had been cut off at the wrist, and nailed against the oak as a warning to malefactors.